These four German representatives turned the incoming booty into currency and gold and deposited it in vaults in the Banco Germanico and the Banco Torquist. All deposits were made in the name of Perón's then mistress and future wife, Eva Duarte. After Perón married Eva on October 21, 1945, they consolidated their hold over the Nazi horde and eliminated any possible interference from the four German trustees. First, Freuder was investigated on a variety of charges, including espionage and fraud. Then, as suddenly as it began, the investigation ended. On September 6, 1946, it was announced that the investigation of Ludwig Freuder was terminated by presidential decree. This was Perón's warning to the four Germans that they were in his country and subject to his whims. Over the course of the next 7 years, they all died violently. Heinrich Dorger's body was found in a Buenos Aires street in 1949. Ricardo von Leuter was murdered in the city in December 1950. Then Ricardo Staudt died in a hit-and-run accident. Finally, Ludwig Freuder was found slumped over his breakfast table in 1952. He had drunk poisoned coffee. This, then, was the country where Josef Mengele arrived in September 1949, a hotbed of Nazi intrigue ruled by a dictator who had lined his pockets with death camp booty. It was not a country that was going to inquire too deeply into the background of any German bearing a Red Cross passport and claiming to be a war refugee, nor was its immigration service likely to take an interest in the address in Buenos Aires that the new immigrant gave upon disembarkation. Had they done so, they would have found a spacious colonial-style house at Calle Arenales 2460, in the posh suburb of Florida, the house of a man named Gérard Malbranche, who had been listed by the Investigating Commission on Anti-Argentine Activities as a suspected Nazi sympathizer. Mengele moved in there after spending several grim weeks in the seedy one-room lodging he shared with the engineer in Vicente López. At the Malbranche, Mengele was known as a model tenant, giving no hint of the tantrums and authoritarian behavior he was to inflict on other hosts in years to come. Visitors to the house included survivors of the German battleship Graf Spee, scuttled in the River Plate after being crippled by three British warships in the first months of the war. Before long, Mengele joined a circle of prominent Argentinians and Nazis who had held important jobs in the Third Reich. All, in their different ways, gave help to Mengele over the next decade and encouraged him not to lose heart in his darker moments of despair. One of the first of these contacts was a former Abwehr officer, Willem Sassen, whose entry to Argentina had been smoothed by the remnants of the Nazi spy network that had so efficiently operated there during the war. Sassen was born in Holland, but he became a member of the SS. His counterintelligence work involved him with the Abwehr's disinformation unit, Scorpion. Since arriving in South America in 1948, Sassen's activities had included acting as a spokesman for Adolf Eichmann. He later gave public relations advice to unsavory South American dictators such as Chile's Augusto Pinochet and Paraguay's Alfredo Stroessner. Interviewed by Britain's Granada Television in 1978, when Mengele was still alive, the chain-smoking Sassen spoke up for his friend, whom he said he first met in 1949. He described Mengele as a brilliant man from an intellectual point of view, a good philosopher, historian, and a very good medical man. Sassen went on, "So, if you take his case and see the horrible stories they are talking about, selecting eyes and I don't know what all, there are no means, we have no means at our disposal to prove to the contrary. if you take the fact that this man, whom I really knew closely, I can say, and who talked to me about the experiments he had done during the war, experiments, for example, with volunteers, crippled people, and others from the armed forces of Germany, in order to know how a man reacts under circumstances of duress, such as cold or heat or water, experiments which are today continued by the Americans and British commandos as well. So those experiments were, of course, done on the bodies of those volunteers. Now, there is another question, that it seems that those experiments were done with prisoners as well, but of course, there is no proof of it. In 1952, Zassen introduced Mengele to Adolf Eichmann, who was living in Buenos Aires under the alias Ricardo Clement. Stripped of his SS colonel's uniform, Eichmann cut a pathetic figure as he shuffled around Buenos Aires in shabby civilian clothes. Unlike Mengele, Eichmann was being actively hunted, his role as the logistical organizer of the final solution having been mentioned in the Nuremberg trials numerous times. The two men met from time to time at the ABC City Center Café, but they never became close friends. Mengele did not like the downtrodden aura of fear surrounding Eichmann, whom he regarded as a broken man. Moreover, Eichmann was virtually penniless, whereas Mengele was getting support from the family in Günzburg, as Zassen explained. "I mean, they are two completely different kinds of people, Eichmann and Mengele. Moreover, Mengele could dispose of his own means, which Eichmann never had. He, Eichmann, was a tragic figure, because in reality that, the final solution, was not his business. He would have liked to have been a common soldier on the front. That was his dream." Soon after his arrival, Mengele also met the man he later called his dear, dear friend, who gave me heart when I despaired. Of all Mengele's many mentors during this period of his fugitive life, none was more valued than Federico Haase, a distinguished architect who lived in Buenos Aires. Haase knew everyone who might be important to Mengele. His wife was the daughter of the man who became Paraguay's finance minister when President Stroessner seized power in 1954. She and her husband provided an invaluable link to the influential Paraguayans who smoothed Mengele's path to citizenship there in 1959. Haase also introduced Mengele to another vital contact, Colonel Hans Ulrich Rudel, Hitler's most decorated Luftwaffe ace, whose extensive political and commercial network of friends would help Mengele in many important ways. During the war, Rudel sank a cruiser and a battleship, and he was shot down and captured by the Russians. He escaped and was shot down again, this time losing a leg. Altogether, he was credited with 2,530 operations and 532 tank kills. His feats were so extraordinary that Hitler created a special award just for him, the Knight's Cross with golden oak leaves, swords, and diamonds. Rudel's name was associated with the escapes of many wanted Nazis from Europe, organized by a group informally called Kameradenwerk, far from the clandestine role that some Nazi hunters have ascribed to men like Rudel. He was, in fact, a shameless publicist and, like Mengele, had a giant ego. Several glossy books featuring hundreds of photographs of his daring wartime exploits have been published, and he was especially anxious to be photographed in a variety of macho pursuits, high diving, hard tennis games, snow and water skiing. Rudel's boundless energy, despite the handicap of an artificial leg, was all part of keeping alive the Reich's lost spirit of German heroism, courage, and discipline. When Mengele first met Rudel, he was in self-imposed exile in Argentina on the payroll of the Peron government as an advisor to the National Institute of Aeronautics in Cordoba. Rudel was also collaborating with Zarsen by giving advice at the Argentine end of Kameradenberg to newly arrived fugitives on such issues as where to obtain forged papers. Although Rudel was an unrepentant Nazi, attending neo-Nazi rallies and visiting SS shrines right up to his death in 1982, his close relationship with dictators Juan Perón and Alfredo Stroessner, and later Augusto Pinochet, made him attractive to several major German firms, including Siemens, as a roving ambassador. It was on one of Rudel's frequent business trips to Paraguay in the early 1950s that Mengele made the first of many trips there to explore sales prospects for his father's firm in Günzburg. The date of this first visit to Paraguay was around 1951, according to three separate reports, recorded one CIA memorandum. He worked for some time as a salesman for a West German farm machinery firm. During the time that Mengele was in Paraguay, he never tried to hide his identity or use a false name, even during trips to Argentina and Brazil. Cross-checked with Mengele's surviving friends who remember this period, the report seems to be one of the few accurate pieces of information that the CIA managed to find on him. To this day, however, Mengele's family denies any suggestion of financial support from the Günzburg firm. Dieter Mengele, Josef's nephew, who now jointly runs the company with Mengele's stepson, Karl Heinz, was quizzed by John Martin of ABC News as late as March 1985. Martin. One of the most frequently cited rumors is that your grandfather, Carl Sr., and the company must, for all these years, have been supporting Josef Mengele. It must be the source of his income. Is that true? Dieter Mengele. That's absolutely not true. The company. My grandfather bought the company in 1911, and then, after the Second World War, he put his two sons, Alois and Karl, into the company. And when these three died, Karl Heinz and I took over the company. And there's no truth at all that Josef Mengele got money or has any shares of the company. That's absolutely not true. Martin. Do you have any idea how he has supported himself all these years? Dieter Mengele. I have no idea. I have no idea. I know that in Argentina he has a little factory where he makes bolts, but that's the only thing I know about how he survives. Dieter's recollection is at odds with the facts. One of the first people Mengele met on his early business trips to Paraguay was a fellow fascist, Werner Jung. Jung was the chief of a German youth group that was effectively the local Nazi party during the war. He had emigrated to Paraguay in 1936 as an executive of a German company, Ferreteria Alemania, which acted as agent for several German companies and sold light machinery and tools. Although it was Frederico Haase who introduced the Jungs to Mengele, Jung's wife, Margaret, recalled, "At the time that Dr. Mengele met my husband, he was representing his Günzburg company and was an acquaintance of Oberst, Colonel, Rudel." It was Rudel who persuaded Mengele that a lucrative market in farm machinery was waiting to be cornered in Paraguay, a country about the same size as California, especially in the well-watered, luxuriant pastures of the southeast. Carl Sr. seems to have earmarked Josef to help the family firm's South American sales drive after successfully exporting a large consignment of farm machinery for woodcutting and milling in the early 1950s. After Alois took over the business in 1954, when Carl Sr.'s health began to decline, Mengele products were sold through an Argentine company called Cafetti. Over the next few years, Josef Mengele traveled to southeastern Paraguay and to farms deep in Chaco, the vast northwest region of the country, a flat wilderness of scrub thorn trees, dwarf shrubs, huge cacti, and scattered hardwoods. Werner Jung said, "He really started to push the family business from 1954 on. I remember he was especially trying to sell a device to distribute farm manure and carts to haul dirt and equipment." It was during a trip to Paraguay in 1954 that Mengele met another key contact, Alejandro von Eckstein. He was then a captain in the Paraguayan army, and together with Jung, he sponsored Mengele's bid for Paraguayan citizenship in 1959. Rudel was on a flying visit to Paraguay, having returned to Germany for an active role in neo-Nazi politics as a member of the Deutsche Reichspartei, when they had their first encounter, as von Eckstein described. Dr. Mengele was a friend of Rudel and Jung, and Rudel and Jung were friends of mine, and we just happened to be presented to one another. And it was from that time on that we would meet on a sort of regular basis. He came here through Rudel. Rudel met him in Argentina, and really was doing well in business here, so he told Mengele. That's why Mengele came here, to get in business. Alfredo Stroessner had just taken over Paraguay, ruling with the absolute power derived from Article 52 of the 1940 Constitution. Article 52 allowed him to declare a state of emergency and suspend habeas corpus. This situation exists to the present day, Stroessner having declared himself president for life. Von Eckstein and the 44-year-old dictator were close friends, both being of German descent and having fought side by side in the 1930s in the Chaco War against the Bolivians. Both Stroessner and von Eckstein were decorated war heroes, as the president still likes to remind visitors when he appears at ceremonial occasions resplendent in gold braid, half his chest covered in ribbons and medals. According to von Eckstein, it was on one of Mengele's visits, shortly after they met, that Mengele was introduced to President Stroessner at a function with several others present. "The president didn't know who he was, and all they did was shake hands," said von Eckstein. "But I remember Rudel telling Mengele that Paraguay under Stroessner was as fine a friend to expatriate Germans as Argentina under Perón." Jung and von Eckstein both found Mengele reluctant to talk about the war, even with his newfound Nazi friends. Jung said, "We knew he was a doctor because he introduced himself as one. I didn't find it odd that he was a doctor who was involved in commercial business. We didn't talk about the war. Maybe if the Germans had won, there would have been a discussion, as there always seems to be with the British and Americans, such as the inevitable question, 'What did you do during the war?' But for Germans, it is best left unsaid, unless the other person brings it up. Mengele never brought it up. Everyone knew that those Germans who had come to South America had started a new life, and there was nothing else that we needed to know. They were there because they didn't want to deal with the past." Mengele became a popular figure on his many visits to the Jungs. Their grand house on Calle General MacArthur in the Paraguayan capital of Asunción was a center for social activity.
"We thought very highly of him," said Mrs. Jung. "Like Oberst Rudel, he was a non-drinker for health reasons. He loved classical music, enjoyed reading good German poets, and praised our good and natural way of life. He was very good with the children, and helped my second eldest son to pass his biology exam."
Back in Argentina by early 1953, Mengele had moved into a city center apartment on the second floor at 431 Tacuary Street, after leaving his lodging with the Malbronx. By this time, Mengele had invested some family funds in a small carpentry business at the corner of Avenida Constituyente and Avenida San Martin, in the Florida district of Buenos Aires. Elsa Haverich, A secretary at the pharmaceutical company Fadro Farm, in which Mengele later became a principal owner, recalls his carpentry workshop.
Approximately in 1953, I met him as Dr. Gregor. That was in the Vanda Laboratory, a pharmaceutical company in Buenos Aires. He used to come every afternoon to visit Dr. Timmermann, a German medical friend who later became one of Mengele's two partners in the Fadro farm business. And we talked, well, about nothing important, you know. And at that time, he had a carpentry or a toy factory. I don't remember really if it was a furniture carpentry or a toy factory, but that is what he was doing at that moment. The factory had some winches, and there were some round things that could have been toys for children. They were made of wood and looked like little trains.
Haverich remembers Dr. Gregor as
very kind. He was very nice. He always used to come in very happy, and he was always making some jokes. He was calm, very calm.
Profits from Mengele's small workshop allowed him to buy a Borgward car, Isabella model, in 1954. His application for a license was granted after two friends, his former landlord, Gérard Malbranc, and a recent acquaintance, José Stroer, wrote that Mengele was a fine, upstanding member of the community, in response to a police question as to the moral condition of the applicant. Stroer wrote in similar glowing terms a year later, when Mengele needed a passport. Today, Stroer becomes excitable when asked about the basis for his judgment on the Auschwitz doctor's morality.
"It's all lies," he shouts. "I don't know anything."
Meanwhile, far away from Mengele's bachelor existence, his estranged wife, Irena, was preparing to marry another man, Alphonse Hakenjoos, who owned a shoe store business in Freiburg. She had met Hakenjoos in 1948, shortly after he was released by the Americans after being captured while serving with Rommel in the Afrika Korps. At the time, Mengele was still hiding in Germany on the Fischer farm. Karl Sr. informed his son by letter that Irena wanted a divorce, and Mengele did not stand in her way. He signed and notarized a power of attorney in Buenos Aires so that a local attorney in Günzburg could represent him and process the divorce by proxy. On March 25, 1954, their petition was approved by a court in Düsseldorf. Mengele was not especially heartbroken, nor was the Mengele family sorry to lose Irena. They had watched with disapproval as she had grown distant from Josef during the 4 years he was hiding on the farm in Mangolding. Irena's parting shot to the family was to tell them proudly that she did not want a penny from them. That winter, in 1954, Mengele moved again, this time to a medium-sized Spanish-style house at 1875 Calle Sarmiento, in the fashionable and predominantly German suburb of Olivos. There he rented half the house and was remembered by the owner's granddaughter as a model tenant. For a fugitive who had had such an impoverished start, life had by now become tolerably pleasant. Mengele had acquired a loyal clique of friends who shared his view of the world. Embittered at losing the war, angered at Germany's capitulation to the Allies in agreeing to hold war crimes trials, fundamentally racist toward his indigenous South American hosts, mentally low-level chattering, he once described their conversation. And there were regular visitors from home. His father once visited him. His old school friend Hans Sedlmeier, Alois's right-hand man, was often in town, and Alois himself made an occasional visit, once with his wife, Ruth. Mengele had also become an increasingly successful entrepreneur. His workshop now employed half a dozen employees, having expanded into machine parts for the textile business. While the workshop ran itself, Mengele made additional monies from commissions earned on sales of the Karl Mengele and Sons products from Günzburg. As his fortunes increased, he became a familiar figure at the leading German restaurants in the Argentine capital. At about this time, Mengele struck up an extraordinary relationship with a German Jewish refugee, who has asked us not to mention his name, fearing the relationship would be misunderstood. The man is in his 70s now, and ran a prosperous textile business in Buenos Aires. He arrived there before the war, escaping Hitler's persecution of the Jews. In the early 1950s, he met a German girl who had been a wartime nurse. Like so many German youngsters, she had been a member of the Hitler Youth Movement. The businessman, nonetheless, was greatly attracted to the girl. She had settled in Buenos Aires with her parents, who happened to know Mengele. On one of the businessman's visits to the girl's house, he found Mengele there, and the girl introduced them to each other. Mengele gave his name as Jose Gregori. Neither the girl nor the businessman had any idea of his true identity. The two men soon found they were competing for the girl's charms, a contest that Gregori eventually won. However, the girl was not the only interest that Gregori shared with the Jewish businessman. Gregori wanted to go into partnership with him. They had several discussions about the possibility of a joint venture, but nothing came of it. During the course of this unlikely friendship, Mengele discovered that his prospective partner was Jewish, but he never once uttered an anti-Semitic remark. This is perhaps not as significant as it sounds. There is plenty of evidence from Auschwitz of Mengele's cynical exploitation of people whose skills he knew would further his career. And in the Jewish businessman, he recognized someone with greater entrepreneurial skills than his own. Gregori seemed to be quite a wealthy man, said the businessman, and I remember wondering where he got his money. Later, the girl told me that he had told her father he was getting help from his father. Carl Sr. had been helping in other ways as well. He wanted to see Josef married again. The girl he had in mind was Marta Mengele, widow of his youngest son Carl, who had died when he was only 37 years old in December 1949. Marta was a handsome woman, actually ravishingly beautiful, as Rolf described his aunt. She had fallen in love with Carl Jr. while still married to a businessman named William Ensmann. In 1944, a son was born, Karl Heinz, whose paternity was disputed in the local courts after Marta divorced Ensmann in 1948. After considering all the evidence in intimate detail, the regional court in Memmingen ruled that the boy was, in fact, Carl Jr.'s son. According to Rolf, Carl Sr. arranged a meeting between Marta and Josef in the Swiss Alps, having deliberately sabotaged an affair that she was having with another Gunzburg man. Rolf, then age 11, was to be brought along as well to meet his long-lost Uncle Fritz, with whom he had walked through the Bavarian forests many years before. Behind Carl Sr.'s matchmaking lay a calculated plan to keep control of the Gunzburg firm totally in the hands of the Mengele family. Carl feared that if Marta remarried someone outside the family, her voting rights, inherited from Carl Jr., could be influenced by that outsider. By marrying Josef, all key decisions would be made securely within the family. But there was another practical reason for the arranged marriage. Under German law, company assets in the amount of Josef's inheritance could be seized if an arrest warrant for Josef was issued. Carl Sr. therefore persuaded Josef to renounce his inheritance by secret legal agreement, thereby averting the possibility of the company being financially paralyzed. But it was just a cosmetic move. In practice, once Josef married Marta, he would benefit from her share in the company, and although he had lost his voting power, she would be directly influenced by him. The travel plans for Mengele's reunion with Marta were laid months in advance. In April 1955, he applied to the Argentine Federal Police for a special passport for non-Argentine citizens. But first, he had to satisfy the police that he had been a resident of good conduct. Again, his friend José Stroer obliged with a testimonial as to his integrity. On September 1st, the police granted Mengele a good conduct pass, which allowed him to apply to the courts for the passport. Unfortunately for Mengele, his arrangements were interrupted by a successful coup against President Juan Perón. Although there had been three previous attempts to oust Perón, he appeared to be solidly in power. But on September 16, 1955, Admiral Isaac Rojas led the entire Argentine Navy into rebellion. Rojas sailed the venerable U.S. cruiser Phoenix, later renamed the General Belgrano, into Buenos Aires harbor and pointed its 8-inch guns in the direction of the presidential palace. Perón conceded, "Damn it, this fool Rojas is the sort of man who is likely to shoot." He sought refuge in the Paraguayan embassy and later boarded a Paraguayan gunboat which took him into exile. Walking up the gangplank, Perón ingloriously slipped into the shallow water and was almost drowned before he was pulled out by Paraguayan sailors. The coup brought the government to a standstill and frightened some Nazis who had relied on Perón for their continuing safety. But they were soon assured that the new regime, composed of the military chiefs Rojas and Lonardi, intended to maintain a business-as-usual attitude toward Nazis. When Lonardi and Rojas were deposed in a second coup that November by another Prussian-style military reactionary, General Arambari, the Nazi community was even more pacified. In the midst of all this governmental reshuffling, the Argentine Court of First Instance finally issued Mengele a 120-day passport. In March 1956, Mengele flew to Switzerland with a 2-hour stopover in New York. There to meet him at the Geneva airport was the ever-faithful Hans Sedlmeier, who drove him to Engelberg, where he checked into the Hotel Engel, the best in town. At the hotel waiting to greet him were Marta, her son Karl Heinz, and Mengele's own son Rolf, then 12 years old. Over the next 10 days, Uncle Fritz, as he was introduced to the two Mengele boys, regaled them with adventure stories about South American gauchos and about his supposed experiences fighting partisans in the Second World War. Rolf was impressed with his dashing uncle, who dressed formally for dinner, had such exciting tales to tell, and gave him pocket money, his first allowance ever. Rolf recalls, "Uncle Fritz was a very interesting man. He told us stories about the war, and at that time no adults spoke about the war. I liked him, as an uncle." Rolf also noticed how physically attentive Uncle Fritz was to his Auntie Marta, although he thought at the time that it was merely ordinary family affection. At the end of the holiday, Mengele travelled to Günzburg to tie up the legal arrangements that his father had prepared. Mengele visited his family for nearly a week, his first open visit to Günzburg since he had been on leave from Auschwitz in November 1944. Following his stay there, he drove in a rental car to Munich to visit his friends, the pharmacist and his wife, who had assisted Mengele after the war. Mengele had barely arrived in Munich when he was involved in a minor auto accident. Although he was not injured, the accident attracted the attention of the local police. They questioned him regarding his South American identification papers and told him not to leave Munich until he checked with them. Nervous about his real identity being discovered, Mengele telephoned his family in Günzburg and requested their assistance. Karl Sr. drove to Munich and settled the matter with the police. according to Rolf. My grandfather paid the police some money to forget about the incident. Mengele left Europe the following day. Heartened by the prospect of more settled times with Marta, Mengele returned to Buenos Aires to unscramble the covert side of his fugitive life. In a moment of insecurity, he had undergone one attempt at plastic surgery in Buenos Aires, haunted by a remark made by his first wife, Irena, predicting that his prominent forehead would give him away. Mengele himself stopped the surgery halfway through. He had had a local anesthetic and could see what was going on. When he saw what the surgeon was doing, he realized he didn't know his subject, said Wolfram Bossert, who sheltered Mengele in Brazil during the last phase of his life. He had scars at the top of his head that showed where the surgery was done. He permanently wore a hat because of what his wife had told him. But he need not have resorted to such drastic measures, because by 1956 there was still no sign of a warrant being issued for his arrest. He felt confident enough to publicly relaunch himself as Josef Mengele. Besides, everyday life had become too complicated for a man living under a false name. Mengele had plans to take out a mortgage on a house so that he and Marta could enjoy a proper family life. He had his eye on a white stucco property at 970 Virrey Vertes, a secluded cul-de-sac in the Olivos suburb that bordered on the back of what had been President Perón's palatial home. But the bank wanted proof of his identity. Also, his father had offered to set him up in partnership with a pharmaceutical company, for which, again, detailed evidence of his identity would be required. Proving his real identity required a great deal of paperwork and the authority of the West German embassy, whom the Argentine police required to certify that Helmut Gregor, the name he was registered under, and Josef Mengele were one and the same man. Mengele had to explain to the embassy, therefore, that he had lived under an alias for the past 7 years. He gave them his correct name, date of birth, date of his divorce from Irena, and addresses in Buenos Aires and Günzburg. On September 11th, 1956, after checking with Bonn, the embassy issued Mengele a certificate stating that his real name was Josef Mengele, and he was from Günzburg. It doesn't seem to have occurred to anyone in the embassy to say, "Wait a minute, here we've got a man who clearly has a past to hide, let's do some checking," said the Paris-based Nazi hunter Serge Klarsfeld. No one in that embassy seems to have checked with lists of war criminals. If they had, they would have found Mengele's name on several of them. Armed with the embassy identity certificate and his birth certificate, Mengele went before the National Court in Buenos Aires to swear that he and Gregor were the same person. The court then issued a judicial certificate, which he presented to the Argentine Federal Police. They noted that all the information he had given on his arrival to Argentina in September 1949 was false, but any questions the police might have had about this irregularity must have been perfunctory. In November, they issued Mengele a new identity card, number 3940484. It listed his name as Josef Mengele, indicated that he was divorced and a manufacturer by profession, and gave his correct Buenos Aires address. Having got his new identity card courtesy of the West German embassy, Mengele returned to ask them for a passport, a mere formality now that the identity problem had been resolved. He even provided his own picture, passport size, in which he sported a mustache, and he filled in the following personal details himself. Height, 1.74 meters. Build, normal. Form of face, oval. Color of eyes, greenish-brown. The non-inquisitive embassy duly issued him a West German passport, number 3 415-574. One explanation for the embassy's oversight might lie in the fact that the West German ambassador at the time, Werner Junkers, himself had been an active member of the Nazi Party and a senior aide to Hitler's foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was hanged at Nuremberg in October 1946 for war crimes. From 1944 to 1945, Junkers was one of Ribbentrop's special envoys to Yugoslavia, where the Ustashi forces even outdid the SS in barbarity when dealing with Tito's partisans. Quizzed about the lapse at the embassy, Junkers said, "Ask the man who ran the consular section. I didn't know who Mengele was." The man in charge of the consular section in 1956 was Werner Schartmann. As of July 1985, he was the newly appointed West German ambassador to Prague. Schartmann insisted, "I didn't know anything about Mengele." In October 1956, Marta and her son moved to Argentina to join Mengele. For the next 4 years, Mengele was effectively Karl Heinz's father, a tie which was to form the basis of a firmer relationship than he had with his own son, Rolf, whom he had seen only twice since he was a baby. Mengele was secure in his life with Marta. He took out a mortgage on his new house in Virey Vertes and registered the deed and the mortgage in the Gunzburg company name, Karl Mengele and Sons. Further evidence of just how secure he felt was shown by the fact that he allowed Marta to be listed in the telephone book under his name, Mengele. Meanwhile, using his brand new passport, Mengele made a business trip to Santiago, Chile, in February 1957. According to Alejandro von Eckstein, Hans Rudel accompanied Mengele on the trip, and they met Walter Rauf, the SS colonel who developed the mobile gas vans that killed 97,000 Jews, partisans, and Russians. Rauf distinguished himself later in the war with the nickname the Murderer of Milan, earned for his torture and execution of Italian partisans. Rauf was living in Ecuador in 1957, but he was making one of his exploratory trips to Chile, which later became his permanent home until his death in May 1984. Rudel, Rauf, and Mengele spent a week in Chile reminiscing about times past. Like Mengele, Rauf was an uncompromising anti-Semite. Shortly before he died, he wrote to a friend renouncing his Catholic faith and saying, "Himmler was my God. The SS was my religion. Why can't people understand that all the big business in America is run by Jews?" Soon after Mengele returned to Buenos Aires, he and Marta decided that the time had come to get married. In July 1958, they flew to Montevideo, Uruguay, for a civil ceremony, followed by a 3-week honeymoon. Again, Mengele registered under his own name, giving his occupation as businessman, the names of his parents, and his address in Germany. In mid-August, they returned to the house in Virey Vertes to resume a life that in all respects resembled that of a couple who felt they had nothing to hide. Mengele's efforts to rehabilitate himself publicly took yet another crucial step. With his father's approval, he sold his workshop in Florida and with the proceeds bought a stake in a pharmaceutical company. Altogether, Mengele funded half of the 1 million Argentine pesos, approximately $200,000 venture capital needed to expand the fledgling company called Fadro Farm KGSA. Fadro Farm manufactured drugs and specialized medical products. Dr. José Mengele was registered as one of the founding directors, along with two Argentinians, Heinz Truppel and Ernesto Timmerman. Truppel recalls, "I saw Mengele for the first time in 1958, about the middle of July,
because the Fadrow Farm Company had just been formed by two people, myself and Dr. Timmerman. This company started with the manufacture of products for the treatment of tuberculosis, and we had our first factory, say, office, at 1551 Aquenga Road in the federal capital, Buenos Aires. Dr. Timmerman presented Dr. Mengele, who also had another name, which was Dr. Gregor. Effectively, Dr. Mengele contributed some capital to the company. Dr. Mengele was not in our company too much of the time, but his contribution of capital allowed us to expand our production department. Dr. Mengele left the company within less than 1 year. When he worked here, he used to do studies of new products for treatment of tuberculosis. He used to read many medical and scientific books, but I want everyone to know that he didn't carry out any experiments on human beings, as some people may think. At first, Mengele introduced himself to his new business partners as Dr. Gregor. Then he found that Elsa Haverich, the secretary who he had met 3 years before but had not seen since, was now working for Fadrow Farm. She said,
"He came into the office one afternoon. I called him Dr. Gregor at that moment because to me he was Dr. Gregor. Then he corrected me and told me that, 'No, it is Dr. Mengele.' Joking a little bit, I asked him why he changed his name. He answered that it was for political reasons. When he got out of the war, he had to do it with another name."
Mengele's life had now stabilized into the comfortable and secure routine of a family man in a 9-to-5 job with good prospects. After 13 years on the run, he felt the worst was over. The worst was still to come. Before long, Mengele's luck began to change. Somehow, he had attracted the attention of the Buenos Aires police on the suspicion that he might have been practicing as a doctor without a license. Exactly what triggered their interest is not known. A man who was a senior city detective at that time said Mengele was rounded up with several other doctors the police thought might have been involved in a backstreet abortion clinic where a young girl had died. The detective admitted to taking a $500 bribe for Mengele's release, which he split with another officer. Police files confirm that Mengele was held for questioning and freed after 3 days. At the same time, back in Germany, a determined effort to bring Mengele to trial had just begun. As of August 1958, Josef Mengele's honeymoon had about a month to run. Chapter 6. Flight to Paraguay. There had always been an intention to pursue men like Josef Mengele to the ends of the earth. As Prime Minister Winston Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt pledged as early as October 1941. The atrocities committed in Poland, Yugoslavia, Norway, Holland, Belgium, and in particular behind the German front in Russia, exceed anything that has been known since the darkest and most bestial ages in humanity. The punishment of these crimes should now be counted among the major goals of the war. But when the time came, this pledge did not extend much beyond America and Great Britain's agreement with the Soviet Union in August 1945 to try 22 Nazi leaders before an Allied military tribunal at Nuremberg and a small fraction of SS murderers at a limited number of other trials. There was only one major Allied attempt to pursue the Reich's murderous physicians in court. That took place in December 1946, when 23 doctors and scientists went before an American tribunal, also at Nuremberg, in the so-called doctor's trial. One man who felt that Dr. Josef Mengele should have been among the defendants was Hermann Langbein,
a left-wing political activist from Vienna who had been arrested by the Gestapo and shipped to Auschwitz, where he was put to work as a clerk in the chief physician's office. Although Langbein's opposition to Nazi tyranny was well known, he survived Auschwitz and in the course of his imprisonment there became familiar with the gruesome activities of the SS doctors, having seen some of the paperwork connected with experiments. After the war, he noticed that Mengele's name cropped up at several trials of SS personnel. He also noticed, with dismay, how the determination of the Nuremberg trials lost some of its momentum after the Allies handed over prosecutorial responsibility to the German authorities and those in the countries where the atrocities had been committed. The record of the newly born Federal Republic of Germany proved to be exceptionally poor. Although German judicial authorities proudly point to 6,215 convictions of Nazi criminals, they disingenuously fail to note that more than 70% of those convictions were the result of indictments brought under Allied jurisdiction. In all the cases brought by German prosecutors, only 403 defendants were convicted of premeditated murder. It became clear that the initiative for bringing Mengele to trial was never going to come from Bonn, and thus was the task left to the tireless industry of one man. Langbein began by compiling a dossier of evidence against Mengele in the hope that the judicial authorities would take an interest. On his own initiative, he cannot remember exactly how, he discovered that Mengele had been divorced and that he had given power of attorney to a Buenos Aires lawyer to handle the arrangements with a Frankfurt lawyer, Fritz Steinacker, who later defended several prominent war criminals. Langbein also tracked down many Auschwitz survivors and recorded their statements in order to build a case against Mengele. In September 1958, only 6 weeks after Josef and Marta Mengele had settled down as newlyweds, Langbein took his file to the Justice Ministry in Bonn in an attempt to persuade them to issue a warrant for Mengele's arrest. But his visit to the capital was not very encouraging. He encountered the first of many bureaucratic obstacles. I saw an official in the state prosecutor's office in Bonn. He told me that his office was not responsible for the question of Mengele. He said it was the responsibility of one of the 11 states of Germany, whichever one Mengele lived in. So he asked me, which state did Mengele live in? I had to tell him that I didn't know. In that case, said the official, I can do nothing until you find out. Angered at the official's obstructive behavior, Langbein left the file on the table, sternly telling him that he regarded Mengele as the German government's responsibility. Coincidentally, in Buenos Aires that same September, Mengele signed over power of attorney to his new bride, signaling that he intended to make himself scarce and needed someone to make decisions that he could trust. There were two drafts of this document, the first on September 13, 1958, the final one signed and notarized in front of his Argentine lawyer, Dr. Jorge H. Gorico, on September 29. 3 days later, Mengele is reported to have entered Paraguay on a special 90-day visa. At first sight, these two events suggest that Mengele had somehow learned of Langbein's interest in his wartime activities, particularly since Langbein was simultaneously trying to convince the state prosecutor's office in Kiel to include Mengele in an investigation concerning his Auschwitz colleague Professor Karl Klauberg, who headed camp sterilization research. The likely explanation is far more prosaic, as are most answers to the mystery of Mengele's amazing agility at evasion. The brush with the Argentine police regarding his alleged illegal practice of medicine certainly must have alarmed Mengele, perhaps even made him consider whether having another haven might be more suitable. But the most compelling reason for his departure for an extended stay in Paraguay was probably nothing more dramatic than an attempt to sell a new manure spreader that the Günzburg firm had just manufactured. It had broken all sales records in Europe. Mengele's Nazi friend, Werner Jung, who lived in Asunción, recalled that it was around this time that Hans Sedlmayr and Alois Mengele visited Paraguay, and that Mengele tried hard to sell the machine. Without much success, however, according to Jung, who acted as agent for several major German companies. I never thought that he would make much money trying to sell that sort of machinery. I believe that Sedlmayr and Alois came at the same time, and they were talking about expanding the business. Mengele himself constantly tried to interest me in becoming the official representing his company. He said I'd do it better than him, and he would have given me a healthy percentage. But at that time, I was already thinking about packing up and going back to Germany. I didn't want to take on new accounts. Jung's words are especially interesting in light of the statement made under oath by the Günzburg firm's purchasing director, Hans Sedlmayr, to the West German authorities in 1971, when they engaged in one of their periodic but half-hearted attempts to find Mengele. Sedlmayr told the investigating judge, Horst von Glasenapp, "Our company has kept up business connections with South America, but since I have been with the company for the last 27 years, no business connections with Paraguay have existed. The accused in no way has been linked to the company affairs. Business deals are organized by our representative agents, and for that reason there is no room to employ individuals on a private basis." According to the Jungs, when in Asunción, Mengele stayed at a boarding house called the Astra, owned by a mutual friend, Peter Fast. Marta and Karl Heinz came to visit him there.
"She was nice. Everyone liked her," said Margaret Jung of Marta.
She also remembered that Mengele had a preference for good German food, in sharp contrast to his later Brazilian tastes. Back in Germany, meanwhile, Hermann Langbein had made a breakthrough in his one-man effort to bring Mengele to trial. Although he had dumped his file of evidence with the obdurate bureaucrat in Bonn, Langbein had persevered in pinning down the state prosecutor's office within whose jurisdiction the Mengele case should properly fall, so that an arrest warrant could be drawn up. From Mengele's war service record, Langbein discovered that his last recorded visit to Germany was in November 1944 in Freiburg, on leave from Auschwitz, when he helped Irena to move to Günzburg for the remainder of the war. Langbein took the case to the Freiburg prosecutor, Freiherr von Schoingen. "He was very helpful," said Langbein. "He couldn't have done more." Langbein also followed up on a tip that Mengele might have studied medicine in Frankfurt. "By pure coincidence, the tip proved to be right," said Langbein. "The university authorities would not let us see Mengele's file, but they did give his date of birth, his date of graduation, and said that he was born in Günzburg." On a visit to Günzburg, Langbein discovered the ubiquitous presence of Karl Mengele and Sons. It was clear to him that the Mengeles and Günzburg held many secrets about their absent son, but that he was not going to be privy to them. All he could do was wait for von Schoingen to draw up the arrest warrant and hand it over to the Foreign Ministry for extradition proceedings. Although Langbein did not have Mengele's exact address in Buenos Aires, he knew that he lived there from the Buenos Aires notarization of Mengele's divorce papers. How much news, if any, of Langbein's efforts filtered through to the Mengele family and was relayed to Josef is not known. Langbein insisted that every move he made was conducted in the greatest secrecy. But the fact is that by March 1959, Mengele had decided that he would be safer living permanently in Paraguay. the strain of tearing up his Argentine roots, just as he felt they had taken hold, soon showed itself to Mengele's friends. On his return to Argentina from Paraguay early in 1959, the staff at the Fadro Farm Laboratory noticed he had become edgy and that he often fell asleep in the afternoon. One of the directors, Heinz Trupel, said, "I suppose that he must have been thinking all the time that he would be found at any moment. That is why he used to sleep during the day, and he looked very tired physically and mentally." Yet a permanent move to Paraguay had its compensations. It meant Mengele could spend more time developing the family business there. He also had his sights set on buying land in the remoter areas of Paraguay, land that, according to Jung, Mengele thought was a valuable long-term investment. Perhaps, too, he feared that the climate toward men like him would change with the recent election in Argentina of President Arturo Frondizi. He was one of the most liberal leaders to come to power since the Second World War, and was known to be sensitive to the first rumblings of international disquiet about Argentina becoming a Nazi sanctuary. When Mengele returned to Buenos Aires from Paraguay to wind up his Argentine affairs, the $200,000 share that he and his father had invested in Fadro Farm was bought by an Argentinian named Ernesto Niebuhr. Mengele's departure from the company was an abrupt affair and took everyone by surprise. "He just called me," said Heinz Trupel. "He told me he was leaving because of questions of different ideology. He said he was going to get out of the laboratory and out of the country." Elsa Haverich recalled the moment vividly. "Mengele," she said, "seemed to be a frightened man.
I asked him, 'Why? What is going on?' I thought maybe it was his family, or an illness, or even an accident. Then he told me very sadly that, no, it was because of political reasons. I didn't ask too many questions, because he looked a bit worried. The following day, the day he had to go, he arrived later, at noon. He looked very quiet that day. He was very sad, very worried. It was about 5:30. He took some books to return to the library. He was always reading science and medical books, and we got in the car. He gave me a lot of advice about the company and what we should do, and I said, 'I'll see you again.' Then he told me, 'Elsa, we will never meet again.'"
Although Marta and Karl Heinz stayed in Buenos Aires, they regularly visited Mengele in Paraguay, relieving the tedium of his life as a salesman traveling from farm to farm. As a sanctuary, however, Paraguay held many attractions. It had already become more popular among war criminals than Argentina, once described by Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, as unser großer Gönner, our great benefactor. Since the demise of Juan Perón in 1955, the Buenos Aires end of one of the more overt escape organizations had been raided by the Argentine police and a stash of false passports found. Nazis had no such fear of robust police investigations in Paraguay. Far off the beaten track, impoverished and remote, Paraguay is still the most primitive country in South America. It is not the most captivating place for any fugitive to end his days. The World Health Organization lists tuberculosis, malaria, typhoid, dysentery, and hepatitis as endemic. Hookworm is the most common disease, and there is much venereal disease, goiter, and leprosy. It is a country where money buys everything. Its leading industry is smuggling. There is no proper tax system. American cigarettes, Japanese electronics, and whiskey of all nationalities provide substantial revenue, much of it finding its way into the pockets of Paraguayan government and military officials. Dozens of small, seedy shops line the narrow streets, all selling contraband perfumes, cameras, transistor radios, and French nylons. Counterfeit Cartier and Rolex watches are sold on most street corners in the center of Asunción. Estimates of the illegal income provided by the contraband range up to $250 million a year. Middle-ranking officers claiming their fair share drive brand-new BMW and Mercedes automobiles and live on sprawling haciendas, even though their basic pay is only $500 a month. For years, senior military officers have been actively engaged in drug smuggling, according to an allegation by the U.S. State Department in January 1985, an accusation that so stunned Paraguayan officials that for the first time in history, the American ambassador was denied an audience with President Stroessner. Shortly after the State Department's charge, Ambassador Arthur Davis's wife was killed in a mysterious Eastern Airlines crash on a flight from Asunción to La Paz, Bolivia. No evidence has been produced, but rumors abound that there was a link. Presiding over this chaotic and corrupt state is the iron-fisted rule of Alfredo Stroessner. Despite irrefutable evidence of systematic torture and imprisonment without trial, he brands all allegations of human rights violations as communist-inspired. Those who share his philosophy have been welcomed with open arms, provided they keep their payments up. The deposed Nicaraguan dictator, Anastasio Somoza, reportedly did not, and was blown to pieces one day as he walked toward his car. Elio Massagrande and Gaetano Orlando, the two Italian fascists who blew up banks and trains in their native Italy for the fascistic organization Ordine Nuovo, have made a new life for themselves in Asunción. There has been a stream of others, all scoundrels, heading for the last refuge in the world. Sooner or later, Josef Mengele was bound to join them. By May 1959, Mengele was settled in Paraguay, still under his own name, ready to begin a new life. He moved to the southeast, in a region known as the Alto Paraná, which borders Argentina. It may not have been Bavaria, but it was the next best thing. Known locally as Nueva Bavaria, New Bavaria, it is populated with settlers whose view of the world is still colored by the notions of one of the spokesmen of late 19th century antisemitism, Dr. Bernard Förster, a schoolteacher from Berlin. In 1881, Förster organized a petition, which was signed by 267,000 Germans, urging the compulsory registration of all Jews and their exclusion from mainstream German life. Unfortunately for Dr. Förster, his views did not coincide with those of Bismarck's Second Reich, and he was so ostracized that he moved to Paraguay. There, he established a colony of like-minded bigots. The result, a century later, is that 60,000 mainly fair-haired settlers live in squat Bavarian-style chalets set incongruously among dense palm trees. They have their own churches and cultural societies and schools where portraits of the Führer and swastikas were prominently displayed during the war. Indeed, Nazi sentiment ran so deep in Paraguay that it did not declare war on Germany until February 1945, 3 months before the German surrender, and then only reluctantly, as the Foreign Minister, Luis María Arguelles, announced to a group of Paraguayan Germans. The Axis powers will know full well what Paraguay's real sentiments are, and will take that into consideration when they finally triumph. But in the meantime, it is imperative that Paraguay play along with the United States for urgent reasons of national self-interest. Mengele lodged at the home of one of the most die-hard national socialists in Nueva Bavaria, farmer Alban Krug, who was also head of the local farmers' cooperative. They were introduced by Hans Rudel. For the next 15 months, Krug's farmhouse in the hamlet of Hohenau, 40 miles north of the border town of Encarnacion, became Mengele's home. The grinding routine of sales rounds was broken by occasional visits from Marta and Karl Heinz, and by weekends when Mengele either took a bus or drove a jeep to Asuncion to relax by the pool at Werner Jung's palatial home. Everyday life in these new and austere surroundings was recorded in Mengele's diary, which resumed at this point after the mysterious 10-year gap. In the diary, he referred affectionately to his host, Farmer Krug, as Major Domo, but he was not so charitable about the sophistication or intelligence of the Krug family. "Sometimes these people get up in the middle of the night, at 5 a.m, to celebrate that solemn ceremony, slurping their mate, herbal drink. For their health and productivity, it would naturally be a lot better if they would sleep 1 or 2 hours longer, rather than wasting their time with useless and mentally low-level chattering. It is interesting that these people, as early risers, consider themselves morally superior to late sleepers." Mengele travelled widely in search of business, to a Mennonite colony near Rosario, north of Asuncion, to Philadelphia, in the heart of the Chaco, across to Pedro Juan Caballero, on Paraguay's eastern border with Brazil, and to San Bernardino and Villa Rica, southeast of the capital. "He was looking for business," said his friend Captain von Eckstein. "He would go where he could make a sale, and stay 2 or 3 days at a time." There were also sightseeing trips with von Eckstein to Indian settlements, although, according to the Jungs, Mengele did not find President Stroessner's eccentric friend the most riveting of conversational partners. "Von Eckstein was a bit of a braggart," said Werner Jung. "He always liked to seem more important than he was. He used to claim that he had royal blood in him. A baron, he's not." A month after Mengele arrived in Paraguay, Hermann Langbein's efforts in West Germany to call him to account finally bore fruit. On June 5, 1959, a damning indictment of his butchery was drawn up by Judge Robert Müller of Court No. 22, Freiburg. The opening paragraph stated that Josef Mengele was to be taken into custody on emphatic suspicion of murder and attempted murder. The arrest warrant set out 17 counts of premeditated murder conducted by a man who had taken an oath to cure, not to kill. The full range of Mengele's cruelty would not emerge for more than 20 years. All the same, the results of the court's preliminary investigation were gruesome enough. Killing numerous prisoners with phenol, benzene, and or air injections. Killing numerous prisoners in the gas chambers. Killing a 14-year-old girl by splitting her head with his dagger, the victim dying a slow, painful death. Injecting dye into the eyes of women and children, which killed them. Killing several twins of gypsy parents, either with his own hands or by mixing lethal poison into their food for the purpose of conducting specious medical studies on their bodies during autopsies. Ordering a number of prisoners to be shot because they would not write to their families saying they were being well-treated. The warrant was circulated to police stations and passed to the Foreign Office in Bonn in order to begin extradition proceedings from Argentina, where Langbein believed Mengele was still living. Despite Langbein's request that the proceedings be conducted in the utmost secrecy, according to Rolf Mengele, an informant in the Günzburg police tipped off the Mengele family that the warrant had been issued. Yet, by the time the family was able to inform Mengele by correspondence of the gathering storm clouds back home, he had already made his initial application for Paraguayan citizenship. He applied for this citizenship as José Mengele. Had he learned earlier of the developments in the Freiburg court, we may assume that Mengele would have taken steps to change his identity and adopt one of the variety of aliases he later used when he fled to Brazil. As it was, the Paraguayan citizenship afforded him additional protection should the West Germans seek his extradition. No formal extradition agreement existed between the two countries, and President Stroessner, although he relied on the Germans for substantial investment, was less likely to make an exception if the request concerned one of his citizens. Next to his self-esteem, the president regarded Paraguayan citizenship as sacrosanct. Citizenship also helped facilitate land ownership, and Mengele had shown an interest. According to a CIA report, Mengele was trying to acquire land in the zone of Alta Paraná, across from the Argentine province of Misiones. The lawyer chosen by von Eckstein to handle Mengele's citizenship application was Dr. César Augusto Sanabria. According to Jung, Sanabria was a prominent Asunción attorney with good government contacts. An important bonus, since President Stroessner had a habit of taking a personal interest in new citizens of his country. Jung and von Eckstein both agreed to act as sponsors for Mengele. Dr. Sanabria clearly recalled them bringing him his new clients. "I remember some German acquaintances in the capital.